This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Susan King says she never wanted to be anything except a gray-haired old journalist. But the business she entered in the 1970s was changing fast. The world of the harried editor haloed in a green visor yelling "Stop the presses" was coming to an end. TV was replacing print. And Susan King was on the air. At Channel 2 in Buffalo, New York, she became the first woman to anchor a major weekday TV newscast.
News Center 2 at 5:30, 6, and 11. We're on the move.
And so was Susan King. She moved from Buffalo to Washington, D.C., worked in radio and TV in local and network levels. In the early 90s, she left broadcasting, got a job in the Clinton administration. When Clinton's tenure ended, she moved on again and joined the nonprofit world and became director of a journalism initiative for the Carnegie Corporation. And there she stayed until she made the wise decision to head to North Carolina. Susan King is the new dean of the UNC Chapel Hill School of Journalism and Mass Communications, and she joins me now in the studio. Susan King, welcome. So good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
And if there could be any doubt about your credentials, let it be known that you were my teacher at Buffalo Normal School, which I think then they called Buffalo State, back in the sort of antediluvian days of journalism.
Yeah, don't give that year, please.
I won't. And you were just one. You know, we were about the same age. I mean, that's exactly it. And I want to look at that period because the mass communications class that I entered, I was one of the first students. Buffalo State started the program. It was one of many colleges and universities that began mass communications programs because of the demand. And the scene, the landscape then was changing pretty fast. And that's the world that you entered as a journalist. So tell us what you were looking at as a young TV reporter at the time.
Well, first, you've now made me feel like I'm a successful dean because I have a student who has turned up interviewing me in this major market on
a student
broadcast.
With a job.
Yes. Well, more than that, with a career. So thank you for that. You know, I thought that I would enter television news at a time when it was really growing. It was not really respected as a news vehicle. I grew up in the New York City area. My family is all from the metropolitan area. And there was a strike, newspaper strike, when I was, I think, in high school. But all I know is that television was where we were getting our news because all the newspapers were not there. We were a big newspaper family. So I thought, oh, that'd be fun to be in a business and help to develop it. And then I feel like sometimes I've seen it go away. The change was happening. I got my job in Buffalo because I had the credential they were looking for, a woman. I had not a bad little resume for, you know, a young person. I had a master's degree now, but they told me don't let anyone know because it was a lunch bucket town and they didn't want people to think I was too smart.
They don't want you to be too smart.
But I had a hunger. So they were going to give me training for a month. And the first day they called me and said, the Supreme Court has just made a ruling about pornography, that communities could develop itself. Go down to Chippewa Street. You remember Chippewa Street?
I do. I heard about it. I was never there.
Bad part of town. Mm. And they said, see if you can do something. And I talked to the strippers in town about the local pornography, et cetera. And that was my training. I was on the air that day and on the air for the rest of my
career. But it's an interesting time because the reason these mass communication programs, of course, were developing was because of the demand. Young people, on the strength of Woodward and Bernstein, were wanting to become journalists. Watergate. Those are the print guys. But television as well, as you said, wasn't quite as well respected, but it did have an impact and people knew. We got to see the Vietnam War and people grew cold because they could see the truth of that war. So TV was also sort of in competition as a credible medium, and they were both in this hot competition.
But I would say part of why the mass communication programs developed was that there was the awareness that it was creating a community out of the country, a national sort of shared experience. The civil rights movement played out on Cronkite News, you know, and here in that area, and the whole nation experienced it through Uncle Walter. So that I think the television also, its impact was being examined. Marshall McLuhan was the big intellectual of that period saying the medium is the message, you know. So that along with the journalistic kind of desire and hunger that Woodward and Bernstein brought together a time when all this was created. And I don't think that world has gone away, mind you. I think that the role of media today is as important in the academy as was there. It's just different now. It's social networks, crowdsourcing, Facebook, who are we? What's the community that we're involved in?
Well, let's talk more about that because that's your charge now, is to figure out where to go from here. How do you pull those things together? What do you tell students that they're in for when they sign up for mass communications at Carolina?
Well, first of all, I think that becoming a communicator, so whether it's a journalist or it's somebody going into advertising or public relations, you know, but figuring out how to do strategy around how to communicate with people is perhaps the best experience for whatever you're going to do. I was in the Department of Labor. You mentioned the Clinton administration. I was Assistant Secretary at Labor. And we were looking at how the workforce was changing in America. So this is sort of early 90s, mid-90s. The world was changing. Remember the 90s? We had low unemployment. We had a lot of money. We had surplus. Different world. But what we also found was that young people were going to have a whole different experience than the generations before. You weren't going to have one job. So my father sort of had one career, right? I knew I was going to maybe have a couple. These kids are going to have maybe 6 to 8 different careers. So learning to be flexible, having skills, which is part of what our school is about, but having intellectual depth is what you're going to need, I think, in your career. And so that's part of what I'm telling people. You need to understand the strategy of communication no matter whether you become a professional journalist, professional broadcaster, a CEO, a entrepreneur, or somebody who's developing the next world of the news business.
So your skill as a communicator, your skill as a storyteller, that could be genetic. But then you talked about this other thing, the intellectual depth. It seems that what we see, the way a lot of information is coming across now through the internet, doesn't seem to require that. Certainly not for processing. It's coming through in very tiny chunks in a kind of scattered format. What's the foundation? Why do you say we need intellectual depth to develop any kind of good storytelling capacity as journalists? I mean, where's the evidence?
Okay, I'm gonna take that in two parts. But first, I'm just gonna answer the question of depth, because we're such an information glut. Society, it's hard to really make your way through all of it. I think journalists really remain the editors, you know, this fancy word people are using, curators. We still need someone to help us guide us through this kind of information to understand where it's solid and where it's not. It's so easy to be manipulated. Our society can be easily manipulated. So that I think the professionals really need to be, they can't just go out and sort of do, I'm rewrite, honey. Let me cover any story I want. Mm-hmm. I think we need people who are more specialists. And that's part of what the Carnegie Knight Initiative on the Future of Journalism Education, which is what I ran, really focused on. That's what we found the industry was asking. And that's what we were sort of analyzing, that you need to come out with some deep knowledge, at least knowledge of how to find information, so that you can put things in context. That's what I think people need at this time. Not just information. We get the headlines. We get the tweets. We get the big story. But understanding it, analysis, that's what I'm looking for from the graduates of our school.
Even that context is hard to define when you go back to those days when there were three networks and we were all sort of in some kind of shared experience. That was the context. We understood that. We understood roughly what it meant to be an American over and against some geopolitical threat that we perceived. All of that was the context. With the fragmenting of our attention now and the fact that we don't get all of our information from only three sources. How do you even develop that? How do you define or find context?
I'm an optimist, so you're going to have to deal with me being sort of a positive person on this, which is why I was so excited about coming to work at a university and with students. First, the fragmenting. At the same time we're getting fragmented, and that is a worry, tweet and all these things are turning people in finding articles that are more in-depth. So the irony is things like New Yorker articles and more in-depth, sort of almost one chapter kind of books had a renaissance or have emerged. Now people are like, why? We're doing it shorter. But people are hungrier for more information. Now, maybe only one fragmented kind of world. That's what's frightening to those of us who knew there was a national conversation that went on in America through three TV networks. That's very fragmented. But one, there is more depth. So I think that's the good thing. But this, the second thing is, I'm not a digital native. The young people think differently. They consume information differently. And so we have to deal with who they are and how they, because it's not going to go away. So the optimist to me tells me that we're going to understand this world better. And so far, I don't see it all as negative.
How is political, let's take a particular example, political coverage, political reporting, how has it changed from the days when you started doing this to today?
And that's the other positive thing that I forgot to mention. There are more voices out there. So that's not a bad thing. That's, in fact, a good thing. You'd get the reality of politics, let's say, from Walter Cronkite, that authoritarian voice, or the New York Times. Don't ask me any questions. Don't tell me your comments. I am the authority. Now we have many voices bubbling up. So that is a positive because there's more people can be heard. The problem is, how do you sort your way through it? So how has politics changed? I'm going to use one of our professors. Daniel Kreis has a book coming out in January about the Obama use of social networking to help him win. I mean, he put together a machine, although he didn't even know what it was about, around social networking. So this summer in Charlotte, while the convention is going on, Daniel Kreis will have all of the uncredentialed reporters who will be in a tent called the People, PPL, and they are people who are going to be blogging and writing about things from an alternative point of view. He is going to collect all their information and see how that influences mainstream media and how mainstream media fix that. So after he does that study, I'll have a better understanding of how the political coverage is going. But I'm going to teach a course this fall on covering presidential politics because we've gone from the boys on the bus to something very different, and I want them to get a handle on that.
Well, the machine is much more polished. That is, the folks on the other end of those questions are a lot better at answering them, and they're a lot more ready for us than they used to be. I want to talk a little bit about that and find out why you were answering, breaking into and opening Walter Cronkite's mail. When our conversation with Susan King continues, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communications at UNC Chapel Hill, you're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Susan King, Dean of UNC Chapel Hill School of Journalism and Mass Communications. So I would take us back a little bit, because you talked about your family being in journalism, and your grandfather owned a paper?
My great-grandfather started The Chief in New York City, which was a civil service newspaper that I worked for in downtown New York for a couple of summers, and my cousins all run it still.
Did you always think or always want to be a journalist?
It's all I wanted to be. I was curious. I was nosy. I thought if I could make money doing it. But I started a newspaper in my grammar school, which was a Catholic school. And I quickly learned there was no free press, you know. But and got the Girl Scout badge. But I was fascinated about how you could write about your colleagues, and then they were reading it, and that whole impact of the give and take of what you wrote and how it's, you know, seen by the institution and by the individual. So I was editor of my high school newspaper, and I went to England for my junior year, and I wrote for that newspaper, and I wrote in college. So I had blinders on. Mm. Journalism was for me it.
And you had a sense of that it had some impact, that there was...
Yeah, I very much was... I experienced the American question and the American soul on television. I was also, Martin Luther King's death and Bobby Kennedy's death were all while I was studying abroad. And I came back convinced then I had to go into journalism because I wanted to say, who are we as a country? What is the American story? I want to see, not only if I can understand it, but I want to share it. And that, I think, is the heart of a journalist. You don't want to just learn. You want to share it with others.
You were back in New York then, worked for NBC for a while.
NBC was my first job. Yeah. With NBC White Paper. I had done a summer watching every documentary was done by NBC White Paper, and then I had the luck to become a secretary there.
Wow. And how was that job for you? You wanted to be a journalist. You were a secretary at NBC.
Yeah, know, that's what they asked young women from college. How fast do you type? And I could type real fast. I'll tell you, I never would reject the couple of years I spent in those jobs. I learned politics, you know, when it didn't really matter. I could just observe things. This was pretty high level, you know, network kind of television. But I also learned the most important lesson of my life. And one weekend, they were going away to do a documentary, and they asked me to write all the telephone numbers down of the key people they were going to interview. And of course, I think this is a stupid thing that I have to do. I'm so much smarter than this. And I juxtaposed about three of the numbers, and they couldn't reach those people. And I learned the lesson. Whatever your job is, you do it well.
Because they were not happy about that.
No.
You then got a job at CBS, and you were actually answering Walter Cronkite's mail?
Yeah, you said in the thing that I read it. No, I had to answer it
all.
Yeah, because he was the most trusted man in America at that time, and he was just flooded with things. And so, he had a secretary who Facebook has let me reconnect with her, which has been fantastic, and she was with him for most of his career, and I became sort of the backup person and was hired as the first person to do this. And I turned that stupid little job, correspondent to Walter Cronkite, into something that was pretty useful. He let me go to get my master's at night, so I commuted from New York up to Connecticut. And I got a credit to analyze his mail, and I also started a small newsletter for all the all the bureaus around the country to sort of let them know how the public was responding to the stories that were on the news that night.
She even turned that into a bit of journalism. It might have been just a kind of a clerical function. So what kind of mail was he getting back then?
You know, amazing mail. People wanted him to run for president. You know, they were constantly urging him to do it. And he was disorganized, you know, so he was like, how could I do this? But they would respond to, why do you have this story on? Where is the bias? You know, all the kinds of things we would expect. But from him, they expected, they trusted him, and they wanted to have his, you know, feedback on what their attitudes were. But you could cluster most of them into sort of some major. So I have about 20 kind of form letters that never seemed like a form letter.
So he wanted, and a lot of people, I guess, wanted his analysis, his take on that.
Yes. And he was a pretty simple guy. I've read his autobiography recently, and he is an AP guy. You know, he doesn't go into, here's how I felt, here's analyzing it. He tells you, this is what happened. By the way, a biography is coming out by Brinkley, and it will be out this late this summer, and it's supposed to be the definitive book on Walter Cronkite. So look for that.
Not David Brinkley, the anchorman.
I always get
the writer.
Yeah, the writer and historian.
Yes. Oh, that'll be great. So you took it another level, the idea of reading it and, you know, sort of having these observations. But now that you're thinking critically about the kind of mail he's getting, I mean, that should give you some insight into the way people were consuming the news and its impact on people. What were some of your observations at the time?
And the responsibility. The responsibility to that public, you know, this was the golden age of CBS News. I mean, this is people like Salant and Paley was still alive. And these are not people that I was dealing with, but I would hear about all the time. And a guy named Sandy Sokolow, who was by Walter's side all his life and you know, is still doing important kind of work. There was a sense in that newsroom that we owed it to the public to give them the best 24 minutes probably of the news that day. And you didn't do things you had a soft thing. We had Charles Kuralt every night. Charles Kuralt on the road, Mr. North Carolina, Mr. UNC, to leave you with a sense of optimism or hope about America, because a lot of things were pretty negative. But there was just great discussion, great debate, and people did respond when we did get criticized. So I learned about the responsibility of journalism in our democracy, and that is something that I will never take for granted, and it is deep in my blood system. I mean, I believe that intellectually, but I experienced a group of people who really did commit to that. It's been hard when the industry has had short dollars and too much debt, and when news has been gutted at the expense of news personnel, et cetera, because the stewardship that Bill Paley talked about in owning CBS was ingrained in me. And I hate to see sometimes when that's had to suffer because there wasn't the profit in it anymore.
Right. We're losing a lot of people. You have told a story, I know, about the moment in the newsroom when the story broke that Jimi Hendrix had OD'd.
And, you know, that was not the kind of thing you'd expect to see on Walter Cronkite. Mm-hmm. But this was also, you know, in the early 70s. So there was a sense that America was shifting. This is the Vietnam War. Protests are sort of at the time, and that Jimi Hendrix did represent the cultural new generation. And so they put that on, and there was a lot of mail about that. Why do we have that drug dealer, that druggie on your air? Because the young producers also saw it as a moment. And now, you know, now think of all the other ones that have followed in that. I mean, we've had them recently. I mean, they start talking about it. Janis Joplin, on and on. Kurt Cobain. But Jimi Hendrix, that was a huge moment. And I remember watching as a young person as they were cutting that and that story and giving it essentially a minute and a half to 2 minutes of our precious airtime because they thought it was indicative of a change in our society.
You know, it was a time, too, when all those people did come together. You talk about the sort of sense of who you were. I actually remember a Dick Cavett show where Janis Joplin, Raquel Welch, and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. were all on the same program talking about kind of where things are going, Hollywood today. And there they are, these two. But they were in the same place having the same conversation. And again, getting back to the fragmentation, we just can't – I don't see as much of that. I mean, it was an amazing moment to see these people together on one screen.
But why not? Why not have some of those people together? Maybe that's sort of an option there because if you can have civil discourse and agree to disagree, the thing that – the if customers are marching with their, you know, their viewer buttons, then fragmentation and sort of really hot button television, at least in the cables, is back in style. Now, some people argue, who are better historians of journalism than I am, that we're back to the yellow journalism days of Hearst and Pulitzer, where you just really manipulated the public, sometimes for your own political good. But people are watching those stations. So Fox became very successful and MSNBC became more liberal. And so there's a dialogue going on. They're just not having it necessarily together. But I think that if you can respect people of different stripes, you ought to have those conversations. And, that may be the next wave. I don't know. But Washington's gridlock doesn't give us a lot of hope.
Well, the other thing that's changed, it seems to me, and I'd like to get your feeling about this, is that the politicians, the people who the press is covering, have gotten better at coming up with slick answers, of being prepared. There were times when, you know, you could get a Spiro Agnew to say nattering nabob of negativity, and it would hurt him for a long time. And now they're just all too slick. Is it? And in fact, you worked in government. You were working in communications, so part of your job when you worked at the Labor Department, and it was HUD at the time, wasn't it?
I did HUD for a very short time. Yes,
is to craft the message. Mm-hmm. Is it getting impossible to get at the truth these days?
Well, I'm not sure it was ever easy to get to the truth. So Bill Sapphire wrote those famous words for Agnew, you know, and he became one of the great New York Times columnists. So he became a media guy. One of the great themes, I think, is the amount of political operatives who have become our newsmen. You know, they used to be my sources. Everyone from Tim Russert, who was in Buffalo and mm-hmm. I covered when I was covering Mayor Mikowski, to our ABC guy who worked for Clinton. I mean, all these guys
Stephanopoulos.
Yeah. They were all political operatives themselves. Mm-hmm. And they are really good at sort of feeling a pulse beat of a public. And so they have developed something and they are slicker. But I think, from my reading of history, Truman had some people that were his advisors. You know, I mean, Ike had people who were their advisors. It's just that they now can manipulate perhaps better the techniques of the news business. But look at the guy with Romney. He's the one who did Etch-a-Sketch. That's not Romney's enemy. That was Romney's own staff member who gave, you know, a kind of terrible image to the public. So slickness can work both ways. I think the question is whether you can get past all the kind of imagery and PR, et cetera. When I was in government, I worked in dull, backwater cabinet agencies. So we were not doing spin. We were the government. You try to get people's attention. My biggest job was to find the problems before the media did. And I will tell you where I was successful sometimes is I would get a reporter with a tip. I would follow it through within the agency itself. And I'd find we had a problem because something was ahead of its time. And remember, I have public relations students in my world, so I want them to be good at it. I try to get ahead of the problem. I was like an investigative reporter in my own place. So I never felt that I perverted the truth in it. I might try to not have it become an eyesore, but we can move it. And one last thing. I worked for Andrew Cuomo, but only for a short period of time. He's a very hyper and hyper good, but he's had some moments where he's blown up as a politician. He's being very successful as governor of New York. One of the best things that I ever did in government was when I worked with him. We ended an agency. I mean, if you believe government's important, then you can't keep every government entity that's ever established. And there was an old Roosevelt housing kind of entity that had all its bureaucracy. We ended it. Government, if it's important, needs to also be strategically looked at, and some government ended.
What made you decide to go into government?
I was at that pivotal moment in my career. I didn't feel I had journalism future. I was sort of in my early 40s. I had a 2-year-old. I wasn't the demographics of going forward. I love television news, but I thought, you know, I could maybe hang on, but I think it might be a moment that I should do something else. I didn't start. I started in something that was a 10-month commitment to the Family and Medical Leave Commission. Legislation had just been passed by Clinton. Congress set up this commission. I thought, let me go see for 10 months the other side of what I've covered. It changed my life. I learned that public service is something that I really liked. You just can't do it too long because there's only one customer that matters, and that's the American taxpayer. And at a certain point, you need to go back a la Washington, go back to being a citizen.
You said that it gave you, first of all, you made a distinction once you took that job between politicians and government, a distinction that you
Big
hadn't
difference.
Made before.
Yeah. People don't think of that. Politicians' job is to be really good at spin. They're like lawyers. Let's be persuasive. You know, you don't have to give the facts. You have to kind of give a plausible storyline. Government, you've got to have facts, and you've got to be able to respond to the public, and you've got to be able to respond. So here's an example. There was a terrible railroad crash, and I got called about 3 in the morning because the students on it were all Job Corps. So that means they were all Department of Labor students. And they were caught in this burning railroad, and the Washington Post and others had got pictures of them. It was just gruesome. I got called because they couldn't reach the secretary, and I was down, you know, at the scene very early. I had to manage a lot of that. And one of my old colleagues in television had the names of all the people who were killed. And he had gotten it from a local politician, wanted me to confirm it so that he could go on. We were still calling the family. And I called a lawyer that with I was working with, and I said, they've already got it. Shouldn't I just confirm it? He said, here's the difference, Susan. You're no longer working for a breaking news organization. You are the government. When we say it, it's real. We hadn't reached all his parents. Mm. I wouldn't confirm it. That's a role that's very intimate, government and public. And it's different than other roles I played.
But you talk about the importance, if you're responsive to the people, that you, there comes a time and every agency has to go. And, of course, that's the complaint, is that even agencies, like politicians, become entities of unto themselves, and whose sole job is to protect themselves, even if they're doing some good. It's all about preserving what we had and getting bigger. I mean, you must have seen some of that.
I see that everywhere. I've seen that in every institution I ever worked for. I probably was I probably did the same thing when I had a new boss that came in from somewhere else and I was the local TV person and I had a nice comfortable slot and he was going to tell me change my beat. Yeah. I didn't like that. You know, the great line about journalists is we, you know, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. I'm just going to say where we are today, circa 2012. The world has changed. We cannot stay the way we were in any institution. And so that I think that there is just a faster cycle of making sure we're on the cutting edge of where we need to be. But I want to use the one word I used when we were off air, values. You have to have some constant values. Respect for a public, you know, respect for facts, and respect for the work that you're doing, understanding its mission. So at UNC, we have to constantly be looking like at our curriculum, which was just renewed 2 years ago, not so that everyone feels like, oh my goodness, they're reinventing it again, but that it's constantly serving the students who are in a faster and faster changing world.
Well, that there could be a conflict there, because when you talked about values, that's a set of assumptions, of fundamental ideas about the reasons that you go forth in this profession. That's one thing. Another is a kind of a vocational thing. We promise to get you a job. We're going to serve you. And if you want a job, here's what you do to get a job. Very often those things come in conflict.
We don't promise you to get a job. We promise to give you the skills that you can go out and find a job. And why I think my story is not one I'm going to tell the students all the time, but why I think my experience is a good one for students to understand. I have my fourth career. You started this program saying I only wanted to be a gray-haired reporter. Now I'm blonde, so I never got even to be gray-haired, but and never will. But the fact is I had to reinvent myself a few times. I think that's going to happen even at a faster pace. So we can't guarantee that what they want to do when they graduate is going to be there. They may have to reinvent the business. We're preparing them for jobs we don't even know that exist anymore. So critical thinking, skills, and a way to strategize about the world. That's what I'm willing to give these students.
What about the values? Where do they come from? How do you develop those and how do you teach those? And do public institutions even care so much about that kind of thing?
Journalistic values. That you really have to have facts. You just don't, you know, you've got to have sources, you know, that you've got to have good writing. We still make every student take news writing. Now, some of my people might say, why do we have to do that? You took news writing from me. My case closed. the values of good writing, good communication, those kind of values, values about communication that's important, not just glib or spin.
Now, at the moment, in your program, almost 60% of the students are now on a public relations track.
58.
So we're losing, and that's common. That's not just UNC. It's happening all over in journalism programs where so much is being devoted to public relations.
But don't think of that as a negative. See, you're seeing public relations equals flack, okay, the dark side.
Talk me out of it, Susan.
All right, so everyone said to me, so Susan, you're leaving journalism and you're going to the dark side.
Uh-huh.
Maybe if I had gone in the White House and I was the White House spokesman, it would be dark side because, again, I'd need spin and persuasion to convince you that I had the best case, not necessarily give you a bunch of facts. Government, again, already describes a little different. As the business changes, institutions that I think are important, museums, science centers, universities, hospitals, are going to have to interact with their public in ways they never did before. You used to be a PR person at any of those institutions and you tried to get the local paper or a national paper to write a story about you. That was success. Now, you've got to develop your own platform for connecting to your public. So just use the hospital. You don't have to get a story about your science fair out there. You could tweet that we have a health fair, health fair. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted to get a campaign about obesity, you can do it yourself and have information out there that will engage with your local community in ways. Those are what I want our students to be doing. So it's journalistic skills. It's photographic skills. It's multimedia skills. It's engaging the public. And that's where I see our public relations and our advertising people working. That's not the dark side.
On the state of things today, Susan King, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UNC Chapel Hill. Just ahead, we will talk about the switch from journalism to government, and we'll talk more about where the program is headed on the state of things when our conversation continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Susan King today, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communication at UNC Chapel Hill. You know, we were talking about, you know, can we keep up with the public relations machinery? You talked about the public good it can do by getting information out there. We also know that there's a fair amount of, you know, polishing the reputations of people who are running for office, persuasion. All that's part of it. There's another side to this, though, the change in journalism, the way media has been restructured, fewer reporters covering more and more institutions. You know, we know the Trayvon Martin story. It's a story about somebody being shot in the street, and the investigation. Was the investigation enough? The press is bringing attention. There's two other stories, very little attention. Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., a guy in White Plains, New York, shot in the chest after a medical emergency, medical alert button goes off. Police break in, shoot him in the chest. Very little attention. One with even less attention, Anna Brown, St. Louis, a homeless woman in police custody. She died in September, and we're finding out about it now. There has been no investigation. Could be routine. It has taken 6 months, and because the family brought it to our attention, because they hired an attorney. Are there too few reporters? Are the institutions going uncovered and getting too comfortable? Are they getting away with murder?
First, the trend of reporter cutbacks is, you know, just frightening for communities, because also good-sized cities but mid-sized cities have all suffered probably more than anything. We have, you know, a third fewer reporters in this country than we had a few years ago. So things aren't going uncovered, you know, like the police beat probably. That is a worry. So what's to replace it? I mean, you know, people have talked about these websites and hyperlocal and all that. There's a transition going there where things are getting lost. I'm going to make the bigger point. The one thing that I felt more strongly about than ever before about, you know, my love for and commitment to journalism was really developed during my Department of Labor days. There was nothing like getting people to focus when I would say, so you've got that policy or you've got this. Would you like to read that in the Washington Post tomorrow morning? You need a watchdog over your shoulder. There is just no doubt about it. That is an important sort of solidifying kind of reality. Mm. If we don't have watchdogs in our communities, in our towns, et cetera, it's a lot easier to just try to sweep things under the rug. And so I believe the interplay of journalism, you know, with communities and institutions is critical. And yes, I'm worried that there aren't enough of them. I'm just the optimist in me says this period of what's being called creative destruction mm-hmm. will turn something new. There's a lot of experimentation going on. It makes me feel like it's not just a zero-sum game, but I don't know what it is.
So as a program, as a journalism program, I mean, how do you prepare for that? How do you prepare students? Or is it to get them to be the incubators?
Well, I think they are. They have to be the incubators with our professors. And it's nice to see people who, you know, did it in different ways, willing to really experiment. So we have this Reese News thing that one of our great graduates gave us. It had no children. We got a hunk of money, and we've created an experimental platform for ways to cover the news where the students are being taught, hey, you can try something and it can fail, no problem. Because a university should be a place, the research triangle is a perfect metaphor for that, where the academic community can try and fail, and that's part of its job. A business with a profit and a bottom line can't fail as much. So local television, local radio, the newspaper, they can't fail. They've got to bring in a bottom line. We can try things. But I'm even looking at ways to see whether our students, particularly our graduate students, could work in the community, particularly since they have the extra added support of great professors, to serve that community in a way. It was one thing I never did when I was at Andrew Carnegie's money, the Carnegie Corporation, was create fellowships at some of our great universities so that graduates could do a couple of years in a community and support. And that's still an idea I'd like to see.
What kind of things were you looking into in that Knight Initiative at Carnegie?
We were looking into how the curriculums would change in order to prepare students for this new world. And we started that in 2002. And I wasn't sure what we'd come up with at that time. I just started talking to deans around the country. And remember, this is pre-Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg didn't go to college till 2004. So the world changed during the time I was looking at it. We launched it in 2005. But the sense is we needed to have deeper knowledge, that the skills bank that people thought that too much time was spent by students perhaps playing radio, playing television, that they really needed to have in-depth knowledge and needed to take advantage of these great research universities where they were studying. You know, that if they were doing a story like on coal, we've got this Powering the Nation initiative that was part of the Carnegie Knight Initiative. We gave a lot of money to do that kind of News 21 experimentation. And our students at UNC have won every national award. We just won in South by Southwest. The work is fantastic. It's called Coal Love Story, if you want to Google it. But they did in-depth reporting in a really innovative way, experimental way. And it's not the coin of the realm yet. It's almost beyond where the media is, commercial media, but I think it's sort of leading some of the way.
Well, and computer-assisted research, I know, is something that gets attention now and then. There's all these data banks out there. If you know how to mine them and then map them, you can come up with a pretty persuasive bit of journalism.
But the difference that the Carnegie Knight piece did was we made sure that in the semester before they did this paid internship where they did this experimental reporting kind of stuff, they also took courses so that they learned from the great scientists in the area and on campus what coal is about, what's the energy dilemma, what was the knowledge they needed to know to then experiment it. So they came up with what's called an energy cocktail, which a lot of people have turned to, that if you want more solar and you want more, you know, clean energy, what would be the mix that you think that would serve your, you know, energy needs, and then what the cost be. And you can see how tough it is to make the kind of trade-offs. And a bunch of the professors who saw this game that the students came up with in their experimental news communication work, they realized that game gave more information than they'd been able to do in the entire semester, because it was the idea that they were trying to leave students with the cost of trade-offs, but they weren't able to visualize it the same way great communicators can do, which is what we're trying to produce, great communicators.
What this made you decide? You reinvented yourself a few times now, and the fourth iteration is a dean. What made you decide to come to the academy?
I worked with deans from 2002 on. I know they're not easy jobs. They're not for the faint-hearted. There's a lot of human dynamics that go into them and shorter budgets, you know, like everyone else. I wanted one more big job. I wanted to lead something. And I wouldn't have said a year ago this time, oh, I want to be dean. It kind of was one of those things that unfolded for me in the opportunity. UNC, I know because it was one of the best of the 12 schools I worked with. Gene Folkerts, who was a very successful dean, was leaving. I said, why, Gene? I then got the call and said, oh, I don't think I'm not a PhD. And whatever that school needed at that time, my makeup. I was worried about leaving my 89-year-old mother, who's still in the suburbs of New York. And my daughter said to me, Mom, You've always told me, follow what you love, and you love journalism. And I haven't looked back. I'm commuting. My husband's still up there. I feel like this is the right place for me, and I'm going to give it my all for a decade. And, in a time of great turbulence. But I'm very honored to be here.
You don't need a PhD. You taught at Buffalo State. That's really it. That's your honorary PhD. And plus, you're in North Carolina. You're gonna love that. What about women? Certainly, we can imagine. I mean, I don't think it's hard to see that life has changed for women from the outside. But from your point of view, women in journalism.
Well, two things. 75% of our student body are women. Wow. So then I say, are they going to go to the top? Are they going to be the leaders? Because when I started this initiative, it was all guys. The deans and me, I used to sort of say. Yeah. Jean was the first and only woman until Syracuse hired a woman to be its dean. So I still see America run by men at the top ranks. It can't stay that way. My one worry is, if we have more women in the news or communication business, will that mean that it'll become a pink-collar ghetto, that there won't be as much money as there were years ago? I was at a meeting at the New York Times about 2 years ago with all its editors, and there were a lot of all women editors. And Janet Robinson was at that time president of the New York Times company, brought together some women with an organization I started called the International Women's Media Foundation. I not only am a feminist, I started an organization for women around the world who are journalists. And we were meeting with those editors. And a couple of them said, my job used to be the most important job in journalism. Now that I have it, I feel like it's been, degraded or marginalized. Well, that's because the money and the power of these institutions have dissipated a certain way. That does worry me. But the bottom line is, women are doing a lot more in every sector of our society. I just don't know where they'll be 20 years from now in terms of leadership.
Well, financing is the other sort of thorny issue here. Publicly traded companies have a problem because of their commitment to investors. Nonprofits, NPR, has shown that that's a pretty good model for this industry. You can be one of the top-ranked news organizations in the country and be a nonprofit. Have people looked at the small profit model, the idea that you're not beholden to shareholders, but that you are, but you can pay your bills and make a little money at the end of the week?
NPR is the model that institutions across America are following. Not only news models. I'm going to use one in Austin, Texas. There's a online news organization started by the guy who was the Texas Monthly producer and a philanthropist. And they saw a news gap in their community, particularly state legislature. And they thought, we need to have this covered. The action has moved to the states from the federal government. Their model is NPR. They produce, they have membership. They have philanthropy. They have events. They have pledge drives. They have a number of different things. It's not doing well in some communities. San Francisco wasn't able to make it. Chicago had the same model. It wasn't able to make it. But I see nonprofits doing the same thing. So educational research organizations, membership, philanthropy, and then trying to sell some of their research. NPR has been an incredibly successful organization, and it certainly had its problems in the last couple of years. But they are producing something the public has wanted very badly in this time of dislocation in the news business. Since 9/11, NPR has grown. It has more reporters in world capitals than anyone else in the country. They even beat the New York Times, I think, last I looked. They give you news all the time. It has become a respected organization for news. That's the mission for NPR. If you go away from your mission, you're in trouble. But whether it is the model for all organizations, unknown. But we've got to reinvent nonprofit models.
Yeah, or small profit. It's always been interesting to me that people will do this crazy thing. They will pay for something that's free, and that's what they do with NPR. And I think very clearly the people who listen to this truly do understand. And no, folks, this is not the fundraiser, but this is me saying we do understand that this is an important thing and that they're willing to pay for it even though it's free.
Right.
Is that sustainable? And then if that's true, isn't there some other model that allows you to charge just to stay open and not to keep the stockholders fat and happy, just to pay the reporters?
Well, you're going to be surprised that I mentioned this other institution called Duke. However, Duke at the Sanford Center had a meeting around just this question of what I would call small profits. And it's an IRS jurisdiction, LLC, sort of limited liability or whatever companies. And there are IRS problems at the moment. The news organizations can't become this. It seems ridiculous. It doesn't make sense. So I think people are looking into it. And yes, I think there are models that can work. They're just not easy and they're not there for the picking. And you know what you have to have? You have to have people who are really committed to the mission, because you're never going to get super rich in any of those organizations.
So tomorrow I'm going to talk to Lionel Shriver, and her new book is called The New Republic, and it's a remarkable book. It's a novel, and it really deals with issues of terrorism and the relationship between terrorism and journalism, the all-too-comfortable relationship. That's her fictionalized version, and I know that you're thinking deeply about sort of the coverage of terrorism and how giving it coverage is kind of what they want, and yet you can't not cover it. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the terrorists have always used journalism. It is the way for them to get to the public. And that we were trained in those golden age of television in Washington to sort of do scenarios around it, because we were so aware Washington was vulnerable. This is way before 9/11, but their Hanafi Muslims was a major sort of terrorism event before there were even portable cameras that I was involved in. And we really, you have to think deeply about what your role is in that community and how you're being exploited. And I think that's why, you know, every student at UNC, I mean, I know I'm sounding like I'm, but I am, I'm the dean. They take part of our core course is ethics. Every student has to have an ethics course. You need to think back to that Walter Cronkite ethic that I grew up in culture, your responsibility to the public. I think that's been lost sometimes in all the branding of me and how big a star can I be. And if I'm on TV, then I can sell my book and then I can do this and I can do that and I can be a speaker at $50,000 a head or something. I'm not against some of our students being that successful at all.
It's not
but
the success. It's just sort of how do we cover terrorism, especially because, you end up on the air using the term terrorist. That's who did this one. And then sort of we're over there blowing stuff up, but we're Americans trying to bring democracy. And, you know, so even the terms itself, sometimes just the foundation on which we stand tends to prejudice a story. And we think we're just reporting the facts. The garbage can blew up, 10 people died, terrorists did it.
That is a nuanced question probably only National Public Radio and UNC Radio would think about. Right. But it's in fact because we just report the news. No, we don't. We call it – I was on the first shows before they had a name. It wasn't Nightline at that time, but it was America Held Hostage.
Right. Right.
I had just joined ABC when the terrorists were, you know, quote unquote, right, took our, you know, our diplomats. These words do have meaning. And that's back to why the ethics. And here's my optimism about social media, etc. Your audience is going to let you know a lot quicker than they would have done back in those days. And the arrogance of all media is gone. So people are now questioning it. You'll even see TV shows where we'll talk about it, because you frame a discussion for America by the language you use. And you have to be careful about that language. Language has meaning.
Susan, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And you've done good. I got myself a big job, and I'm happy with it. So thank
and I got
you, Susan.
Myself a big job
and you got
right
a big
near
job
you.
Too.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Susan King, Dean of the School of Journalism and Mass Communications, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. State of Things is produced by Alex Granato and Sean Wen. Megan Modafari is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.